Today's podcast is sponsored by the people at Aura.com. Now, Aura offers identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, a VPN, password management, and antivirus software all in one easy-to-use app. This means that if your online accounts or passwords are leaked online, you'll be alerted quickly, which means that you can be secure from hackers, scammers, and noisy advertising companies. The narcissists are everywhere. Literally, a friend of mine signed up and Aura found his passwords 9 times on the dark web. So go to Aura.com/Dr. Carter. That's Aura.com/Dr. Carter. And use my link and you'll receive a free 14-day trial. And if you continue, then you'll be able to save an additional 40% off all plans. So thanks to the people at Aura.com for sponsoring this episode.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Surviving Narcissism podcast with your host, Dr. Les Carter. I'm Michaela, the program director, and in today's episode, Dr. Carter welcomes Guy Winch to discuss why narcissists can't admit being wrong.
Hey, Team Healthy. I'm so pleased to be with you once again here today, and we have a special guest. So you may be very familiar with him already, Dr. Guy Winch. He's in New York City and has a very strong presence in the public media and the public eye. Now, you have a practice. Guy, first of all, welcome and thanks for being a part of our Surviving Narcissism podcast here.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Okay. And you have roots in both the UK and in New York City. And you have a private practice of counseling right there in New York. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, I have a practice that it's a small practice given the other things that I do. But I do have a private practice in New York City.
Okay. And then on the side, then you've written books, The Squeaky Wheel, Emotional First Aid. I love those titles. And then you've given multiple TED Talks, and those have been received by literally millions of people. That's why I suspect that quite a number of people in our audience already know who you are. You have a podcast. Dear Therapist, it sounds wonderful. And then you've actually been a part of some advisory councils with respect to how to make mental health more accessible to the public and all like that. Multiple articles on Psychology Today and other periodicals. And of course, you have GuyWinch.com. So, I mean, you're out there and you do quite a bit in your spare time, I'm sure.
Exactly. All in my spare time.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. I'm always interested in knowing how did you get into this field of psychology and the therapy and then all of the speaking and writing that goes along with it? What's the backstory with that?
Well, the backstory was psychology. I just was one of those people. I consider myself fortunate because I always knew what I wanted to do. I didn't have to go to college or figure out if I wanted to and what I do afterwards. I always was interested in the human mind. So it was psychology for me. And I started out, I got my PhD at New York University here in New York. And then I did a postdoc and some more training. And then I started out just as a regular therapist. And I, at some point, had an idea for a book. So I kind of pitched it to an agent at a party, literally, and just like a bare bones idea. And she said, oh, I can sell that. Why don't you write a proposal? And then I did. And then I wrote another book. And then I had an opportunity to do a TED Talk, and just one thing rolled into the other. None of it was like, this is my plan.
Yeah.
World domination. It just kind of, you know, evolved.
Organically unfolded. Yeah. You also have a twin brother too that's in psychology, right?
I do. My first TED Talk, Why We Need to Practice Emotional First Aid, is about our relationship as twins. And because, you know, the premise there is that our physical health and our emotional health are twins, but we don't treat them like twins. And, you know, as a twin, I'm offended. And
Well, and I read that as part in one of your articles. And it's just like, yeah, that's such a great insight and wisdom that goes with that. Today, I'm going to want to talk with you about something that I know you've written on. And you know that we're constantly looking into our channel. We're constantly looking into why narcissists are the way they are. And it strikes me that one of the things you've mentioned is there are simply some people who cannot and will not admit they're wrong. Do you remember the Happy Days with the Fonz and all those guys, the TV show?
Yes.
Okay, and Fonzie was the tough guy, and he at some point he had to actually say I was wrong, and they have him just stammering I was wrong, and he couldn't get it out. It's a big joke and all, but there literally are some people who are like that. They cannot say I was wrong, I blew it, I made a mistake. Would you forgive me? Now let's just kind of start with a very basic question, and that is, why is it even necessary for anybody to admit when they're wrong?
Well, first of all, it's necessary for two reasons. It's necessary for the other person who they might have wronged or offended or might have had some kind of consequences as a result of them being wrong. It's important to validate, especially when the evidence is quite stark that they were wrong, that, yes, I take responsibility for my actions. We're taught as kids. Like you see plenty of 4 and 5 year olds get marched into a room, look somebody and go like, I'm sorry, I did something wrong. In other words, we teach kids that adult responsibility or just basic human responsibility is to admit when you're wrong. It has a value for the person who's admitting they're wrong because by knowing what your mistakes are, by taking ownership of them, you have the chance to avoid them going forward and perhaps improve. If you can't admit you're wrong, you also can't admit to yourself that you're wrong, and therefore you can't fix mistakes and avoid them in the future.
And there are some individuals who will say, Doc, you got it all wrong. They're wrong. There's no way that I'm going to just put myself out there and let people take pot shots at me. So there's some individuals that'll take a very basic thought like what you just said and flip it and say, no, that won't work because, and there's a cynicism that seems to go along with that. The implication being, you don't seem to understand people the way I understand people, and you can't put yourself out in a vulnerable space like that. I mean, what would you say to that?
Really, you can't even do that with your spouse. You can't even do that with your best friend. You can't even do that with somebody you really trust and are close with, who, if you have a relationship, you're both bound to be making mistakes throughout it. Does it not feel good when somebody else takes ownership of theirs? In other words, that idea of if we admit we're wrong, we are suddenly vulnerable to the slings and arrows of everyone around us is quite misfounded. People usually respond to somebody saying, I'm sorry, with like, well, thank you for saying that. It's usually a way to repair a relationship, not
And it
a way to
actually creates
sabotage
a
it.
bridge from one person's heart to another. Oh, you did something wrong. I've done it, something wrong too. We have something in common. It's like, no, I can't do that. Now, I'm obviously I know this for a fact, but a person doesn't turn 21, and now I'm an adult, and I think from this point forward, I'm not going to admit being wrong. This is something that's been on the inside of them for a long time. It's not a realization that they just snapped upon and just made it their mantra, but it's been building for quite some time. What tends to be kind of a broad, if you will, history of in the making of this inability to be vulnerable? I mean, how far back are we talking about, and what factors tend to be in place?
You could probably track it back all the way. In other words, the parents of someone like that or the older siblings will say they were always extremely stubborn. They were always somebody who blamed everyone and everything around them for their mistakes rather than take ownership. They were much more likely to go, no, it's your fault, or, and be oppositional. Or, like the signs of that are there from the beginning, in usually one form or another. And if you know someone like that and you've known them their entire lives, truly with childhood, then you saw sparks of it early on.
One of the things I talk about relative to narcissism is narcissists tend to think competitively, one up, one down. And if I were to say to you, hey, guy, I blew it, I did something wrong, I'm making the assumption that you would be a healthy person and I would be a healthy person. And I don't think either one of us would think, oh, this gives me an advantage. Or now that I know something about you, I can use that against you. But apparently, that's what's going on in some of these individuals. Talk about the competitive nature that seems to be in play.
There are two things, the two implications of what you just said. One is the competitive nature, and the other is paranoia. Because the idea of if you just admit being wrong about something that you were wrong about, and that will present a liability, that people, an opening for people to attack you, is slightly paranoid. Again, if you're admitting you're wrong to someone who's close, to someone who matters to you, or if you're admitting you're wrong because it was so obvious and blatant that that's the expectation of everyone around you, people would actually put the matter to rest once you do that. The idea that then they will pile on because now you look weak is a distortion on that person's, in that person's thinking, because in fact it requires emotional strength to admit that you're wrong rather than weakness. It's a sign of strength. The weakness is the person who can't admit they're wrong because they cannot tolerate it.
And so many of these individuals couldn't see that to save their life, could they?
Well, when somebody has, they wouldn't own it. They wouldn't admit it, because the structure of somebody who's like that internally, the defensive coping structure of somebody who's like that, is such that the threat of admitting that they're wrong is to their ego.
Yes.
Now, they might project that externally and say, no, the threat is that I will then be attacked. But the threat is their own self-esteem is too brittle,
yeah,
to sustain that quote-unquote wound, because it's unpleasant to admit you're wrong. If it weren't, everyone would be doing it. It's actually unpleasant. It's, you know, it's a big boy thing to do. And so if you can't do it, literally constitutionally, because you're too fragile to take on that admission, because it means you're a terrible person or something, then it's a sign of how fragile you actually are. And the people who can admit they're wrong are much stronger in that sense, because they can absorb that. It doesn't shatter their self-esteem. It doesn't shatter their perception. It doesn't, in their eyes, make them vulnerable to the whole world now. It makes them more of a stand-up person. It makes them more of a humanist.
There are people that, listening to your words, you just use the word, for example, fragile. And there might be someone that that will take that as a judgmental word. And obviously, I don't think that you were being judgmental whatsoever. It's just a description. You know, each one of us has a certain amount of shakiness on the inside, or uncertainty, or, you know, frailty. But when the narcissist in particular hears a word like fragile, they're going to be thinking, and going back to your word paranoia, you're trying to do me in, aren't you? And they hear judgment where it's not necessarily there, which then tells me they had to learn to think that way at some place in their life.
What is fragile is their defenses, their defense mechanisms, or their ego, rather. Because if their ego is fragile, our ego is the thing that gets hurt when we're attacked or when we admit that we're wrong. It's a bit of a wound to the ego, because we're owning that. Now, when you have something that's very fragile, you need to put a lot of defenses around it. If it weren't fragile, you don't need so much defenses around it, because it can sustain blows. And the narcissist's ego is extraordinarily fragile. There are no small assaults or small insults. Everything gets through does damage, and because their defenses are so fragile. And that's the thing that's fragile about them, their defensive structure around this ego.
And it's an identifying feature. I mean, it's just a part of who they are. Yeah, it begs the question, what are they so afraid of? What are they defending against?
Well, shame, primarily. This experience of, again, if you need to make yourself as to be much more, much bigger, much, you know, like more impressive than you actually are, if you need to put out a front that reflects inaccurately who you are, why do you need to do that? Why isn't who you are sufficient? Why isn't it okay to be a member of the human race who makes mistakes? Because we all do, and we make many of them. That's just nature. Everyone knows we all make mistakes. Refusing to admit yours sets you apart. It doesn't, you know, make you a member of the human race. It supposedly tries to keep you above it, but it tries to keep you above it because you can't take it.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, you know, with it, that it will sabotage their relationships, because it's not an equal reciprocal thing.
I want to mention that I want to read a thing that I pulled from one of your articles. You made a comment that says, these people are not just choosing to stand their ground. They're compelled to do so. And I thought that was a very poignant point that you were trying to make there. And that's such as, an essential distinction that we can make, that they're not just choosing, they're compelled to say, no, you got the wrong person here. You can't say these things. Oh, what's the compulsion there?
The compulsion is the inability to tolerate the idea and the experience of them being wrong, because it's too damaging to them. It's too devastating to admit. Now, if you think about that, we're all wrong all the time. It's not that much of a big deal. But if it's that devastating to you to admit you said one wrong thing or did one wrong thing, if it's that devastating that you have to avoid it at all costs, including, by the way, distorting the reality that you perceive and that you project outwards to other people, if it's that big a deal, that's what I mean about the fragility. You must really not be able to handle much.
I want to share a story, and it's a positive story that it was one of these light bulb aha moments that I had when I was a teenager. To set it back, education was a big deal in my family. My father has his doctorate, and then my mother wound up with a master's degree in education. And I heard all of my life, your mother was so smart that she skipped the third grade. And then her birthday was in September, which meant she would have graduated from high school at age 17. But your mother was so smart, she finished high school when she was 16. And so I heard how smart my mother was, and she was, and the grades were very important. I always made good grades. And then this is important to the story. She wound up in her early adult years typing doctoral dissertations. And this is back when you had to type everything up on the typewriter. And she was very good at it, super fast. One day I came home from school, and I made the first and only D on my report card that I'd ever made. And I was humiliated. It was a class that I didn't like. I didn't like the teacher, and I was being lazy and rebellious. And so I thought, I'm going to have to go and tell the smartest person in the world about who I am. And so when I went inside, I handed my report card to my mother, and I just blurted it out. It's like, you're going to see a D on there. And I know it's terrible, but that's what's there. My mother looked at me and said, I made a D once, and I almost fell over. And then she said, I said, well, what'd you make a D in? She said, typing. And here she was, this genius typist. And it was like, so you're not going to ground me, and you're not going to go get a baseball bat and bang me up and all of that. It's like, no, you can do better than that. Why don't, let's figure out how we can do that. And it was such an enormous relief. I'd like for you to be aware of my video courses. One is entitled Ready, Set, Connect. Now, narcissists are quite capable of throwing you off balance. So this course keeps you focused on the skills and the mindset that are necessary for positive connections. And inside the course, we have various modules that inside each module are lessons, and each lesson contains a video, written documents, and then questions that go along with it. We'll discuss things like how to have good conflict resolution skills, building empathy, how to be the authentic self that you need to be. If you're interested in enrolling, you can go to our website, survivingnarcissism.tv, click the link for courses. You'll find Ready, Set, Connect there, as well as the others. I hope that you would find them to be quite helpful.
And now back to Surviving Narcissism with Dr. Carter.
Now, I'm assuming that there are a lot of individuals, when they make a D, or they do something wrong, or there's a moral failure, or they slip up on a project, it's like, oh no, if I expose that, it is going to be curtains for me. I'm assuming there's a huge compare and contrast there between the way healthy people do it versus unhealthy people do it.
Yes, but it's also important to note that when we're talking about adults and not children who are coming home, or adolescents who are coming home to, you know, tell their parents about a bad grade, when it comes to adults who are trying to do this, and it's not about being screamed at or being, it's just taking responsibility. It's just taking ownership. That's part of the adult contract we have, this unspoken contract we have in the world. We expect people to take responsibility for their mistakes. And then it ends in most cases. But we expect people to take responsibility. We note when they don't. We don't note as much when they do because that's the expectation.
When it's obvious that you have somebody that just cannot and will not say, I blew it or I'm wrong, it leaves me wondering, do they think that other people are stupid? I can get away with this and nobody's ever going to know. I mean, what's in their mind relative to that?
They're not admitting it to themselves either that they're wrong. In other words, that defensive structure can't take their own self-admission that they're wrong. So it's not that they're knowing, like, well, I made a mistake, but I'm not going to admit it. They start to weave a different version of reality in which they were the victims in the situation. There were all these external things, and someone's actually just trying to put the blame on them when they're not accounting for all these other things that happen. And then these distortions start to kick in, and there's just an entirely different narrative of what happened in which their behavior is excused, whatever it was, or their conduct is excused, and everyone else is to blame. Again, the pattern of not admitting you're wrong comes with a pattern of externalizing blame for everything in your life to other people and circumstance rather than yourself. You're just a lack of ownership all around.
Yeah, and that's a few minutes ago you mentioned that when you have to appear strong, then that's when you're weak. And so one of the elements of strength is to be able to say, yeah, there are times when I'm not on my game, or I'm not there today. And
Yeah, I do think of it as just as in a more humanistic way, as in we are humans, we make mistakes. There isn't a human who does not. It's just part of our experience, of our existence, of our ability to multitask and the bandwidth and all of those things. It happens. The question is, like, why is it so difficult for you to just own it when it happens, or to learn from it when it happens? Because again, I said that earlier, if you don't admit it to yourself, you can't learn what the mistake was. You'll repeat the mistake ad nauseam.
Yeah, it's almost as though these individuals have a commitment to their own dishonesty. Would that be an appropriate way to put it?
But they don't perceive themselves as being dishonest. They perceive themselves as being victimized.
Okay, talk a little bit more about that. How does that narrative play out?
If you spend your life looking to justify what went wrong for you by external reasons. Well, that person tripped me up and that wasn't fair. And this person had it in for me anyway. And they should have considered this, but they didn't. If you're constantly pushing responsibility for anything that goes wrong out from you, then you can never change your behavior so that you avoid mistakes because there's never behavior to be changed. It wasn't your fault in the first place. So
Okay.
these are people who will repeat their mistakes till the grave. They will do the same things over and over. One thing about narcissists, they are extraordinarily predictable.
Yeah, in fact, I have people that write comments. Are these people just all drawing out of the same playbook? And it's kind of, yeah.
Yes, because if you can't, because certain things follow. If you can't admit you're wrong, if you can't identify you made a mistake, you can't correct it, you'll keep doing it and doubling down each time you do.
Yeah, when you mention that they have this victim's mindset, that goes back to what you mentioned a few minutes ago about the paranoia. You're going to do me in, aren't you? That kind of thinking. It's what I refer to as assumed hostility. They assume it's going to be there before it even shows up.
Right. And it comes with a grandiosity sometimes because the idea that everyone is out to get me implies that you're important enough for everyone for them to make you a target in the first place.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you all are probably out there just wondering, how can I bring this guy down? Okay, let's bring this down to the level where so many people in our audience actually live. Okay, let's suppose you have a family member and you're at a large family gathering, or it's the person you live with, or it's the person you work with, and you're saying, hey, this didn't work out well, or my opinion doesn't match with yours. Why don't we talk? And then you keep having this sense that says, I keep running into a brick wall. When you're the person who is observing this and you're getting sucked into all of the frustration that goes along with it, what does it do to that individual who sees it but can't get that other person to see it?
It was very frustrating to be with someone like that because if you're not someone like that, then you'll admit that you are wrong. Hey, we had an argument. Maybe I shouldn't have said X. Maybe you shouldn't have said Y. No, Y was fine. I could have said Y, but you shouldn't have said X. In other words, it's very, very frustrating. You're not dealing with the same set of rules And so they can constantly go outside the rules to quote unquote win or not engage or feel like they're winning. And that's a very frustrating experience. And when you try and say to them, hey, say one thing you did that was wrong. Like, why do you always have to harp on that? Why do you always have to be right? And then the projection begins. You always have to be right. That's your thing. You always have to. And suddenly the attack is on the other person. And
yeah,
that's the way they do it. And that's why it's so, it's like mercury. You can't pin it down. It's just so slippery and glib, and it just gets out of the way. And then if you really corner it and go, here's black on white, how you are wrong, why are you against me all the time, why do you attack me? So now the conversation has shifted to feeling victimized and attacked. You can't get there.
Yeah, you can almost feel the hair on the back of your neck just standing up. It's like, oh, I've been through that so many different times. One of the biggest mistakes that I tell folks that you can make is you can make the mistake of thinking that this person is going to think normally. You know, I know I can admit it. Surely you will be too. You'll be able to do the same. And what you're saying is no. There's a very common theme that goes along with narcissism, and that's the absence of self-reflection. And I guess going back to your talk about defenses, that's all a part of that, isn't it?
Correct. And look, the other really frustrating, you know, thing for, you know, dealing with somebody who, you know, who's like that is that people fall into this trap all the time. They think, okay, but this person is not stupid. They have reason. So I can convince them. If I keep trying, I will be able to convince them and get them to see the thing that they don't want to see. And energies are invested
and
attempts are made. Well, mostly on the person who, you know, is getting so frustrated, but look,
yeah,
but I'll show it to you, but I'll prove it to you, but you can't show it by reason when somebody isn't reasonable. And you certainly can't show it by fact when somebody distorts the reality. So you're not sharing the same facts.
So let's suppose then that you are that family member who's trying to, you know, talk some sense into that other family member who's just not having it. Where does that leave you? How do you respond without pulling your own hair out?
Well, you shouldn't go down the rabbit hole each time and trying to, you know, launch a campaign to convince somebody of something they're not willing to be convinced of. The best thing you can do is say one thing and then disengage and say, like, I completely disagree. I know you never admit that you're wrong, but in my book you were, and I'm not discussing it. And then you walk away.
Yeah.
Because or they'll probably get the last word shouted after you, but you're not going to convince them. The best you can do is minimize your losses by not going to so much effort and aggravation to try and do it when it's not going to work.
Yeah. One of the things I talk about is sometimes brevity is your best way to speak into that. When that person is stubborn and they want to aim at you and tell you you're the problem here, not me. Sometimes, like you say, well, I guess we think differently, don't we?
Right. And then I always say, look, I always suggest the use of an imaginary eject button, like the fighter jets have, you know, you press it and the canopy goes up and off you go with your parachute. That's what you need for conversations with people like this. The minute you start getting frustrated, it's not going to work. Eject, right? You know what? Sorry, done with the conversation. My last thought is this. I'm sure you'll shout one after me, but I'm done.
Yeah. When you say this to people that you work with, what kind of rejoinders or comebacks do you get from them? It's like, well, doc, I guess that sounds okay, but yeah, because I know that people are bargaining with folks like you and me thinking, yeah, but I can't deal with that because it leaves so many loose ends out there. How do you speak into that?
Well, usually I say to people, how many have you ever been successful in convincing them to change their mind on something when they were wrong about it, or to take responsibility? And if you never have, it's a fool's errand. And yes, it's incredibly, incredibly frustrating. And sometimes you can disengage from the person entirely, but often it's a friend, it's a family member, it's a colleague, it's somebody that is in your life and you can't disengage from them. And also they might be very nice and pleasant other than those kinds of moments there. But what I say is that the only thing you can control is, you know, when they lay out the trap or when the trap is there, the only thing you can control is whether you're going to wander into it and get your leg ensnared or not. And that's what you can control. So don't get ensnared and leave yourself the option to walk away.
Yeah, and the person who refuses to take responsibility is in super high control mode. And then I go back to that comment about how competitive they are. It's like, oh, I am going to win. And so it's almost as though they want you to go ahead and enter into that argument with them, because I'll show you. And so what I'm hearing you say is, well, what if I don't enter into the argument?
Well, yes. I mean, it's difficult to never enter into the argument because something just aggravated you that you would like an apology for. So there's something going on there. But don't get into the argument which requires them to admit it or to own it. That you won't win. You can get into the argument, okay, you know what? You don't think you were wrong. I think you were wrong. But next time you have to make dinner regardless. You can bypass it
Yeah.
sometimes in that way.
One of the things that most of us like is we like to have, at least emotionally, we like to have things tied down and neat and in its place. But what I'm hearing you say is, well, sometimes it's pretty loose-ended, and we're
Well,
going to learn to live with that loose-endedness.
look, living with somebody who's a narcissist is an endless exercise in frustration and compromise. Certainly you need to marshal your own resources and not, get yourself too miserable or too aggravated, and people ruminate about these things and stress themselves out for hours afterwards. Self-care requires you to disengage as well.
Okay. As you work with these individuals who just it's like you're not going to get me to say anything wrong, are we to just assume, well, I guess they're just not workable, and you just kind of let go and let them be, and just like, hey, good luck, see you some other time. And I mean, because it feels defeatist, and yet, where does it leave us?
So look, when narcissists come to therapy for all kinds of common reasons that everyone else does, it might take a therapist a while to spot, primarily because they're going to be very curative in the information that they give you. They're going to tell you a story in which they were indeed aggrieved and wrong. You might maybe suss it out and go like, wait, that doesn't make sense. But then you did this thing, so how do you might spot it, but it'll take a while because they're going to tell you the story of all these terrible things that happened to them, and your job as a therapist is to be compassionate and validating and supportive and all of that. But once you do, you can start to challenge it a little bit if you see that it goes nowhere. I mean, when I work with narcissists, which is not often because, they usually, my perception online, at least, people is that I'm blunt and I'm a, like I say things directly. It's not appealing to narcissists to go to someone who will say things directly. It's appealing to go to someone who will just be very comforting and supportive so that not many come to me. And if somebody ends up with me by mistake, then they leave quickly because they're not getting from me what they're looking to get, the validation. I'm constantly trying to redirect them to, well, where's your piece? And what about you? And so it's not the therapy they want, and they won't stay long.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, the best way that you can be in a therapeutically appropriate mindset is to individualize your efforts. In other words, I can be a person of peace, even if that person in front of me is not. Or I can be somebody that manages my anger reasonably, even if you choose not to join me in that effort. And that's so hard, because we're kind of hardwired to want to engage well with one another. But sometimes you just kind of have to let go of that ideal and say, well, I guess it comes down to me being responsible for me, which is kind of the whole point of what you're saying here. They won't do that, but then can you and I take that mindset nonetheless?
Right. And that since it's not going to be fair play, then you have to either figure out if that's something that you're willing to be in because it's not going to be reciprocal, then same rules will not be applying to both of you in this relationship, whatever it's about. Is it something you want to walk away from? Or if you cannot walk away, how do you minimize the damage to you?
Yeah, and I mean, even your word relationship, you almost kind of have to think, well, is this really a very deep relationship, or is this just a transaction? Is that all we're dealing with here, or is this just some, an agenda we're all supposed to read off of and just do that? And sometimes you have to resign yourself to the fact it's not going to be very deep, and whatever relationship we have, it's going to be of a minimal kind of level. I mean, is that appropriate to say that?
It's going to be, again, narcissists can be, when they're not triggered, when they're not feeling defensive, then the pathology doesn't come into play as much. They can
Right.
be fun and they can be interesting and they can be nice and they can be warm and they can be very loving in their way, at least verbally, in terms of what they express. They can love bomb, even like really, engulf you with all their efforts at certain times. So it's not that they don't have anything to offer. It's that when course corrections need to be made, when, as any relationship, there are going to be some, issues, some ruptures that occur in the relationship, some problems to address, that's when you're going to be very limited in what you can achieve. But if you can keep it to the fun times and try and avoid those, you can get a lot out of it.
Yeah, in other words, know who you're dealing with and then adjust your expectations accordingly.
Correct.
Dr. Guy Winch, you've given us so much to think about. I so appreciate you being here with us here today. And, I guess there's a challenge for each one of us, and that is going back to your comment, we each need to take responsibility for who we are. And rather than me trying to make that other person see, well, you need to do it too. It's like, well, that's where they are. But bottom line is, I still have my own mental health that I'm working on. And if they're not, I'm heading on a good path anyway.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, and I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. You've got a lot going on, and I appreciate you being here with us here at Team Healthy. Anything else you want to say before we wrap?
Well, first of all, it's been my absolute pleasure. I hope it's been helpful, and people can find me, as you said, at guywinch.com. But it was a pleasure talking to you, and I like unpacking things like this,
Thank
and I
you.
hope
And
your listeners
we're
enjoy
going to
it.
have some of your contact information below the video here so people can know who you are and just get that much more informed. Thank you
Okay,
so
thank you so
much.
much. Thank you.
Okay. And hope to see you again. Again, thanks.
Thank you for listening. Surviving Narcissism is the product of many years of work done by Dr. Les Carter. Dr. Carter is a best-selling author and therapist with more than 40 years of experience, specializing in anger management and narcissistic personality disorder. You can find more content from Dr. Carter on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Surviving Narcissism, as well as on his website, survivingnarcissism.tv. Thank you for joining us for this week's podcast. We are so glad to have you on Team Healthy.